Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to The Powerful Patient. I'm Joyce Graff and we have a really interesting show for you today. I have a very special guest with me, Dr. Ira Chasnoff. Hello, Dr. Chasnoff. How are you?
I'm fine. Good afternoon.
So Dr. Chasnoff is the president of Children's Research Triangle and at the Illinois College of Medicine. Did I get that right?
Well, they're not close. Associated, but
but
they were correct.
Okay.
I'm sorry, you've lost the sound. I can barely hear you. Oh, we're located in Chicago, and we specialize in taking care of children with special needs, the majority of whom have been exposed to alcohol or drugs during pregnancy.
Right, and I know when I was pregnant, I had a side effect that was called rhinitis, which means basically that you have a postnasal drip for 9 months, which is really thrilling. And
right.
And I said to my doctor, you know, I know you don't want me to take medications, but this is driving me crazy and I can't sleep. And he said, well, I don't want you to take cough medicine, but we do know that small amounts of alcohol are okay. So pick your favorite liqueur and have a tablespoon or two before you go to bed and that'll work. And I did that. And my child's okay. But one of the things you said in this book is that there is no safe level of alcohol. So tell us a little bit about the ideas and misconceptions around the use of alcohol and drugs during pregnancy.
Sure. There are a lot of people who don't quite understand what the problems are. But the reality is that any of us can be because there are other factors that are genetic. We have children that are born with mothers who drank alcohol, and one twin has full-blown fetal alcohol syndrome with significant intellectual disabilities, and the other twin is normal, and we have several cases like that. And hello, I'm sorry. No, it went out again. It was a lot of static, and then it went out.
I tried making a change here, because I'm sorry. I'm in a suboptimal environment myself. Is that better or worse?
That's better.
That way. So you were saying that you had a set of twins, one of whom is heavily affected, and the other is unaffected by the alcohol exposure. So are these fraternal twins or identical twins?
These are fraternal twins, and it's an indication that one twin was genetically more vulnerable to the effects of the alcohol than the other twin.
Right, and that would be impossible to predict, obviously.
Right.
But
that's why you can't turn to any one woman and say, here's how much alcohol is safe. Now, with identical twins, they're
equally, right, because they have the exact same genetic makeup.
Right. I'm sorry, you went out again. I can't hear the question.
So, can you hear me now?
Now I can, yes.
So, it's the same mother's behavior, the same environment in the womb, and yet the genetic predisposition of the child had it turn out differently.
That's correct. That's correct.
So the best advice we have for everyone is if you just don't use alcohol or drugs at all in pregnancy.
That's right.
Is that right?
Right. And, you know, we certainly don't want to turn into the pregnancy police, but it's something that we have to address calmly and matter-of-factly. And the facts bear out the information that we really are not at a point where we have any thinking for her.
Yes, I'm sorry, we're having
I'm sorry, I've lost you again.
But I'm going to call in on a different line myself because I'm not in the best environment myself today, and I thought it was going to work, but it doesn't seem to be working so well. So how about I'll meet you again in 1 minute.
So you want me to call you back?
Yes, please.
Okay. All right.
Okay. Right. Hi, this is Joyce. Can you hear me okay now?
Yeah, I can hear you. There is still static, and there's an echo.
Right, the echo. I probably am not going to be able to do much about. Let me try. I've got the
other
static
mic. Cleared up.
The static is better. Hang on 1 second. So is this better or worse?
That's better. I can't hear you very well, but, it's better than nothing.
Okay. Yes, I apologize. Okay, let's carry on. So, one of the problems is that the worst damage sometimes occurs before the woman even realizes that she's pregnant.
Yeah, alcohol has a direct effect on the fetal brain. It crosses over the placenta, and it can cause changes in the structure and function of the developing fetal brain. So alcohol as early as 20 days after conception, which is certainly before anyone knows they're pregnant, a blast of alcohol, you know, if you go out and binge before you know you're pregnant, it can cause something called agenesis of the corpus callosum. It's when the baby is born missing a middle section of his brain.
Missing?
Yeah.
Wow.
Agenesis means, you know, the Bible means beginning.
Yes.
Agenesis means no beginning.
Amazing. And there's another segment of the pregnancy where you said the effects can be pretty bad as well, right?
Yeah, I mean, any time during pregnancy, alcohol can affect the developing brain. And it depends on when the drinking occurs as to what parts of the brain are affected, so you can get varying pictures. The factor that complicates things the most is that the great majority of children affected by alcohol exposure look normal. And it's only, you know, the brain functioning that's affected. So the kids, although they look completely normal, can have significant learning and behavior problems.
So you have this beautiful child, and you expect them, of course, to be perfect and succeed in school and all that sort of thing, and things are just not going the way you'd like them to go.
Right. And they often, you know, and the upshot is they often get diagnosed with something like ADHD and get put on medications, and then they get worse because it's not a true ADHD that you're seeing, and that's what makes all of this so difficult.
Right, and sometimes they're born into ordinary families where the drinking may not even be realized. Sometimes there's a closet drinker, but many of these children are born to women who have been using a lot of illegal drugs and alcohol, and in that case, the children are usually placed in a foster home or an adoptive home. Is that true?
Often, yes. We have a lot of adoptive families that we work with, some of whom knew about the alcohol use, but a good number who adopt and, you know, think everything's fine, and then by 3 or 4 years of age end up in our clinic trying to figure out what went wrong. And we will evaluate the child and find that the child has been affected by prenatal alcohol exposure. And the response from the parents is kind of twofold. They're devastated, of course. On the other hand, they're often relieved that there is a reason, because they've been blamed. People have been blaming them for the child's problems when, you know, they didn't know exactly what it was they were doing wrong. And so to find out it's a biological effect, it does take some of the guilt and shame off the parents' shoulders.
Right, but nonetheless, it's very difficult to manage this. And so
Yeah, you get into issues of not only recognizing the problems, but then what do you do about them? And although most people want to jump to medication right away, that is not the first step. There are so many other factors to consider.
So what do you recommend in a situation like that? How do you work with parents in this situation?
Well, if we see a child like this, the first thing we'll do is a full evaluation. And our team in Chicago has physicians. I'm one of the physicians. We have physicians. We have several child psychologists. We have infant mental health specialists. We have, you know, access for occupational therapy, physical therapy, and then a variety of different kinds of therapeutic interventions. So what we'll do initially is evaluate the child, and a team, physicians, psychologists, occupational therapist, whoever is indicated for that child, we'll get together and we'll spend 1 or 2 days just doing a full evaluation. And then from that evaluation, we'll develop a treatment plan, and then we'll help the family implement the treatment plan. So there are interventions, and, you know, we've published, and it's there's quite a bit in the book about the kinds of interventions that we have found that actually do work.
Right. And so part of this is that the brain hasn't properly developed, and so the child's not able to take information in and synthesize it in the normal way.
Right.
Is that, have a paragraph in here that I found quite fascinating, that you're talking about Johnny. This is on page 18, and I should tell everyone, the book is The Mystery of Risk, Drugs, Alcohol, Pregnancy, and the Vulnerable Child, by Dr. Ira J. Chasnoff, M.D. So I'm on page 18, and you're describing this boy named Johnny. His intellectual deficits often are manifest in poor comprehension and a porous memory. One of his teachers likens it to Swiss cheese. She says one day he'll seem to have mastered in a certain academic area, and then the following day it's totally gone. But then it might be back the next day. It's kind of like, some days he knows how to pull out the information and other days he doesn't. There are holes where things fall in and out. It's like Swiss cheese.
Yeah, children with alcohol exposure, often you could think of their memory problems as Swiss cheese. That's why I talked about it there, because there just seems to be gaps in memory that just don't make sense to anyone else. And that's part of this, you know, one of the issues you have to address, especially as you develop school and educational programs for the children. And again, it's children who look normal, so there's no outward expression of the difficulties the child is having.
Right. So you have this beautiful child, and the interactions are just not happening, where there's misbehavior and other outbursts that are difficult to handle.
Right. You know, what it comes down to is there's something I talk about in the book called information processing, the way we process information in our brains. There are four steps: the way you take the information in, then how you put it together so it all makes sense, that's called integration, and then how you store it in memory, and then when it's time to use the information, how you shift information in your brain so that you can actually use it to guide your behavior and your learning, you know, your emotions. And it's alcohol can affect the parts of the brain at any one of those four steps. So some children with prenatal exposure will have difficulty bringing information in. Other children can bring the information but have trouble processing it.
Mm.
Some children bring it in and process it correctly, but then they can't store it in memory, so they lose it. And then some children just simply, they know, you know, and these are some of the most frustrating of the children. They know what the rules are. You know, they have it in memory. They just can't use the information. There's I think another example I give in there, a little boy, Jimmy, 4 years old, going into the lunchroom at school. And the teacher says, "Now, Jimmy, what are the rules in the lunchroom?" And Jimmy says, "You don't run, you don't hit, you don't pinch." But then when he goes in the lunchroom, what does he do? He runs, he hits, he pinches. So the children have trouble transferring the information so that it actually controls or regulates their behaviors. And so they get labeled as oppositional defiant disorder and get put on medication, when the real issue is they have damage to the part of the brain that does help transfer information.
So what hope is there for a child like this?
Well, there are different therapies, and, you know, I talk about a lot of them in the book, but one of them, I'll just give you an example, is a therapeutic program that we developed here at our clinic here and have published, and it takes the child over a 12-week period through a whole curriculum in learning to self-regulate so that we can actually teach children how to work around the deficits or the blank areas in the brain and to use information more cognitively so it can help control or regulate their behavior. So there are a variety of interventions that can be used.
So it sounds like the first message for a parent of a child in this situation is that no matter how much patience you have, you really are probably not going to be able to do this alone. You really need professional assistance.
Right. I think there are some guidelines. The first thing is, if you have any concerns at all, the earlier you develop, the earlier you get the child some help, the better you're going to be. And what the research shows is that if you can identify the child with the alcohol exposure and get them into some services before the age of 6, they do much better long term. So those first 5 years are really critical. So the first thing is, if you have concerns, even if, you know, your doctor says, "Oh, don't worry about it, he's just a boy," keep pursuing, you know, find a specialist who can evaluate the child. So get a good, full evaluation. And from that evaluation, you'll have some treatment strategies, both for school and home, that will help in a lot of ways.
So obviously your clinic is a good one to go to, but how does one find such a clinic in another city?
You could go, well, obviously the internet, I would imagine, if you put in fetal alcohol syndrome treatment, you would probably pop up with a lot of sites. There aren't that many clinics across the country. The other is several of us are listed in the federal government's listing. If you go to cdc.gov, the CDC, that's the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. But the CDC has linkages to a lot of treatment programs nationally.
When you say...
I'm sorry, the sound went out. I don't hear anything.
Okay. When you say it's best to get help before age 6, that's before the child enters the public school. And so while the teachers might begin to pick up on this, the key would really be if the parents would pick up on it.
Absolutely. Yeah, you want to try to do something about this before the child hits school age. Now, it's never too late. And
Right. We've
done research with, you know, older children, adolescents, and, you know, there are some successful strategies. But clearly, the earlier and the younger the brain, the better it's going to do.
So this is this is that brain plasticity that we've heard about in other ways, that it's still possible to help evolve the brain a little bit more.
Yeah, that's one of the interesting things that's coming out in a lot of research now, is that where we used to talk about brain plasticity in early infancy, we know there is some level of plasticity even later. So,
Right. Well, and speaking of giving up,
I'm sorry, I can't hear you. I'm sorry, there's no sound.
Okay. Go ahead. Why
there you go. You're back.
I'm back now. Okay. So one of the things you pointed out, sometimes the adopted parents or the real parents give up on the child and put them into social service setting or something in a serial foster home.
Right, and that's where we get into the environmental issues. We have a study where we're looking at that very issue, and we find that the more difficult the behavior, the more placements in the foster care system, and in turn, the more placements in the foster care system, the worse the behaviors. So that constant disruption is what's causing, or adding to a lot of the problems.
Right, and any child, even if they started out with a perfectly normal brain, being in a series of different foster homes will cause a lot of emotional turmoil.
Right, yeah, with every disruption, it's more and more of the emotional problem. And now, again, this is where things get complicated because we know, aside from prenatal substance exposure, that early trauma also causes changes in the brain. Neglect, early trauma, such as exposure to violence, severe neglect, so that, the child is getting a double dose of risk factors. And it's sometimes hard from a purely research perspective to know how much of the difficulties the child is having, how much of the difficulties are from the prenatal exposure and how much from the postnatal, trauma. But it doesn't, from a clinical perspective, it doesn't really matter. What we have is a child who is at extremely high risk for long-term problems because of a variety of multiple factors, impinging on his brain development, both before birth and after birth.
So what would you say is the probability of success if someone does get the right intervention for this child? Is it worth their investment, I guess, is where I'm going with this.
Yeah.
How likely is it that we can actually make a big difference for this child?
Well, that's very hard to say without knowing a particular child.
Right.
General statistics don't really give us information for a specific child. But it certainly is worth the evaluation. You can develop.
Right. So it's always worth trying. And
it's always worth trying.
And doing it by. Because programs like yours have worked with many children over many years. Strategies that you have, and one set of parents and one child are not likely to hit the right combination on the first try.
I'm sorry, the sound is going in and out, so I'm not quite sure I understood the question.
So what I'm saying is that the one set of parents working with one child, no matter how hard they try, and they're not likely to come up with the right combination of treatment factors that you all have come up with over the years and over working with many children.
Yeah, I think it would be very difficult for a family to try to go it alone. There is a certain level of denial. Families just don't want something to be wrong. But the best thing to do is to get that evaluation. But and see, and then the treatment not only addresses what's wrong, but importantly, we identify the strengths of the child and then use those strengths, and that's where we build treatment from.
Great.
So that, and again, when I in the book when I talk about treatment, that's what it's all about, is building on the strengths of the child.
That's terrific. So if there is hope for these children, but we really need to get the right program pulled together for each child, and each child is going to be a little bit different.
Right. Yeah, there's no question about that.
Right. So you have a chapter here called Problem Solving as Opposed to Tearing Out Your Hair, how parents and children can use behavior management strategies at home. Can you give us an example or two about the kinds of strategies that you would recommend to parents and teachers?
Yeah, one of the things I do is take the reader through what I call the eight steps to managing behavior. And the first step is probably the most important, which is identifying the real behavior, you know, what the problem is. And I'll give you an example. We had a little boy, Joey, and the difficulty for Joey is that he was always jumping out of his chair at school. And the teacher would say, "Joey, sit down." And Joey would sit down. He was very compliant. But, you know, 2-3 minutes later, he was jumping out of his chair again. And the teacher would say, "Joey, sit down." And he would sit down. But then he'd jump out of his chair again, and the teacher would say, "Joey, if you don't sit down, I'm sending you to the principal's office." Now, right there is the first mistake. And a lot of parents and teachers, all of us, find ourselves saying, "If you don't stop that, I'm going to give you a timeout."
Mm-hmm.
That's something that I call a distant consequence. Whereas the only thing that children will respond to is an immediate consequence. So let's think about this. Let's say you went out for breakfast this morning, and you were at the buffet line, and they had scrambled eggs and wheat toast. And, you know, you're being very good. But then you get to the end of the line, and they've got the sweet rolls. And, you know, with lots of sugar glopped on top of it, the donuts, you know, a little sweet something. And you look at those donuts, and you say, "Okay, if I eat that donut, my blood sugar is going to go up, my the blood pressure is going to go up, my salt levels, you know, the sodium levels, you know, I'm going to die of a heart attack if I eat that donut."
But which is a distant consequence.
The immediate consequence of how good that donut tastes is what drives your behavior, and you reach for the donut and you have it. So if adults don't respond to distant consequences, something as severe as death, why would we expect a child to respond to, "I'm sending you to the principal's office," which is a distant consequence?
Mm-hmm.
So the first thing for Joey is to identify what the behavior is. And the behavior that we see is jumping out of his chair. The second step is to collect the baseline data. We have to understand. And at this step, you have to differentiate what's normal and what's not. And the way to do that is the kind of information you want to collect is two basic things, is duration and frequency. How often does he jump out of his chair? Now, Joey is 8 years old, for not just dementia. So you might expect an 8-year-old to jump out of his chair once or twice during an hour period. That would be normal. So, but then sit right back down on his own. But Joey's jumping out of his chair 7 times during an hour, and when he does, he's staying out of his chair. He's wandering around the classroom. So frequency and duration are more than what you would expect for normal.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third step is, what's contributing, what's driving that jumping out of his chair? And so we ask the teacher, you know, do you think Joey's jumping out of his chair? And she says, "Oh, it's because he wants attention." Well, no, that's not it. Most children want to be good. And in Joey's case, this was true. He wants to be good. He's trying to sit in the chair. But what that results in is a tension, an internal tension of, you know, escalating so that he's trying hard, and finally there's this all this tension to stay in his seat, and the only way to relieve that tension is to jump out of his chair, which feels so good. So his immediate gratification is a release of tension. So that's what we have to address. So the step four is, what can we do to replace the behavior we see? So, because you can never take a child's behavior away from him without giving him a replacement behavior. So in Joey's case, if we know jumping out of his chair, the purpose is to release tension, can we find another behavior that will help him release tension? And so part of our therapy with the children is, in fact, teaching them other ways to release tension. Muscle relaxation, going to a calm, peaceful place, removing them from a situation. Now, in Joey's case, what we did is we taught him some muscle relaxation exercises that he can do in his chair, squeezing a lemon. So he's squeezing a lemon with both hands as hard as he can, that kind of muscle contraction, and then release will relieve that tension. There's another exercise we call the jawbreaker, you know, biting down with your teeth as hard as you can. Nobody else will see you doing it. It's not going to disrupt the classroom, but it allows the child to release tension. So the next step is to talk about this with the child and decide how you're going to approach it. And then step seven is to get this all set up and decide with the child exactly what he's going to do, in this case to release tension. And then step eight is to watch and see how things go and evaluate if it's working. And what you do is you track the frequency and duration. And what you'll see is he's jumping out of his chair much less often. And when he does jump out of his chair, he's not staying up out of his chair for as long. And you will get improvement over time.
That's terrific. So do you find that in most cases it's possible to keep the child in the regular classrooms?
Yeah. Now, the children with full-blown fetal alcohol syndrome who have significant intellectual disabilities are going to need a full individual education program, you know, an IEP. So they probably will not be in a general classroom. But many of the children with prenatal exposure have completely normal IQs. Their global cognitive functioning is normal. And their intellectual disability is mild to moderate. So, yes, they are in the general classroom. Now, the teacher may say, I don't have time to do special things for, you know, this child. I have so many children in my classroom. But many of the interventions that we create are good for the whole class.
So that's interesting. Teach them to the whole class.
Yeah, I could give you, I'm thinking, here's another case from my book. And this young man we'll call Will. Now, Will was born to a mother who used cocaine and alcohol and was adopted right at birth. And the adoptive mother is a special education teacher. So she was pretty sure she had this thing licked. You know, she knows special education. She was going to be able to handle all this. And so, they went along. But by 3 years of age, she was finding she needed help. And that's when she showed up at our clinic. And we began working with Will. And things were really going along very well. He got into school. And the school was having some difficulties. But mom, being a special ed teacher, was able to communicate with the teachers. And, again, things were just moving along fine. He got to third grade, third, fourth grade tends to be the place where you start seeing some significant increase in difficulties because of the nature of learning by that point. So one day, mom got a call from the teacher at school. And the teacher said, you know, you've got to put him on Ritalin. If you don't put him on Ritalin, he cannot come back to my classroom. And mom said, well, you know, what are you talking about? What do you mean? She says, well, and so the teacher told her story. And the story was, the class had been to the aquarium the day before. Chicago has a wonderful aquarium.
Right.
And they had seen dolphins. And so they, you know, saw the dolphins and had a class discussion there. But then the next morning, the class came in and the teacher continued the conversation about dolphins. And it was one of those magical teaching moments where she could tell she had the whole class in hand. Everybody was listening. Everybody was on track with her. She was feeling really good. When all of a sudden, Will jumped up and yelled out, we have Charlotte's Web at home. Well, the whole class just started laughing and cutting up because Will had just completely disrupted the whole class. And the teacher was beside herself. And she said, either you control him and get him on Ritalin, or he's not coming back.
Hmm.
So I got permission from the mom to talk with the teacher. And often when I work with teachers, and sometimes with parents too, I'll do a behavioral log. But a behavioral log is not on the child, but on the adult. And so I asked the teacher to tell me about her day, to write down everything that had happened that day up to the time that Will jumped out of his chair. So a few days later, I got by email a document, you know, from the teacher, and she showed that she'd gotten up that morning, gotten ready for school, brushed her teeth, took a shower, came to school, went to the principal's office, got her mail, came back to the classroom, opened her mail, the class came in, and she began her session on dolphins, at which point Will had jumped up. So I said, well, that's really good, except I need more details. Well, at this point, the teacher was getting a little aggravated with me, but she complied. And a few days later, I got more details. The teacher had gotten up that morning, and, you know, she had brushed her teeth with Colgate, and she had taken a shower with Dial soap. You know, she was getting a little sarcastic with me. But anyway, you know, she came to school, went to the principal's office, got her mail, came to the classroom, opened her mail, and in the mail was a poster announcing a new edition of Charlotte's Web. Beautiful poster. So she put the poster up on the wall.
Uh-huh.
The kids came in, and they started their classroom. Now, what had happened is every child in that classroom was getting pulled off task by wondering about what that poster was doing there. But, but Will, because of his prenatal exposure to alcohol and cocaine, doesn't have the regulatory capability to ignore the poster, to stay on track. And the tension was rising, and he was getting so tense trying to figure out what the heck that poster was doing up there that he couldn't stand it anymore, and he jumped up and said, we have Charlotte's Web at home. Now, if that teacher, when the class had come in, had said, class today, we're going to talk about dolphins. But before we start, I want to show you this poster about Charlotte's Web. It's a book we're going to read soon. But today we're going to talk about dolphins. If she had put that poster into the context of the classroom, it would have helped every child's learning, not just Will's.
Right.
And so it's little things like that that teachers can do that will help all children.
Right. Well, and this sort of meditation or release of tension strategies that you talked about are good things for all children to learn, too.
Absolutely.
Not to mention adults.
It would, and adults. It would certainly address some of the issues of violence that we have in the classrooms.
Right. Now, you talked some about the good enough syndrome and how we as a society might be able to make a difference here in a better way.
Right.
Could you share some with us about that?
Yeah, that's actually my favorite chapter because I got to really get into some of the policy issues. The good enough syndrome is a term I developed for the book that basically says what we're doing for children and families is good enough. you know, it's just that's all we can do. And you know, there in these days of all the debate over the federal budget and the state budgets, we're seeing very clearly that we're cutting school hours, we're cutting school days, we're getting rid of health care for the poor, because in the short term, that's going to save money. But in the long term, it costs a lot more than it saves. And, you know, we seem to be turning our back on some of the most vulnerable populations, and in a sense saying, that's good enough. That's all we can do, and that's going to have to be good enough. But one of the examples I use in the book is if you pretend you're standing 10 feet from a wall, and then you walk halfway to the wall, you're now 5 feet away. And you keep walking halfway to the wall, you'll get to a point that you're close to the wall. You may even be able to touch the wall, but you won't ever really get to the wall because you keep taking halfway steps. And that seems to be what we do often from a policy perspective, is we go halfway and say, that's going to have to be good enough. And what I've tried to do in this book is show how, and using, you know, real children from our clinics and from my work with families and children over all these years, is to show there are steps we can take that don't cost a lot of money, but take some time and investment in interest and attention to the child, that we can get beyond the good enough syndrome, and we can give children and families really what they need.
So as we start,
right. So, right, and there does seem to be a very high noise level these days.
Right, and it seems to be going up. And a lot of what is thought sometimes to be in the autism spectrum might also cross over into alcohol and drug exposure, doesn't it?
Yeah, one of the interesting things is there certainly seems to be a rise in autism, and we don't know why. But a lot of children referred to our clinic with a diagnosis of autism, when we actually work them up, we find they don't truly meet criteria for autism. And what you have to realize is autism is something that's based in the midsection, the limbic section of the brain, and so is alcohol exposure. The problems we see with alcohol exposure are also based in the limbic system, the core central part of the brain. And that's why many children with prenatal exposure look very similar to children with autism. And so we have to be very careful as we evaluate children that we really understand what we're seeing, and we stick to very strict diagnostic guidelines to help us. And that's how we can develop the appropriate treatments for the children.
So is there a definitive way to tell the difference, or is it just a judgment call based on this analysis that you've done?
No, there are criteria for both. And through this assessment, anyone who's been trained in this arena will be able to at least differentiate where some of the problems are coming from. It's not easy. It's not something that, you know, anybody can do.
It's not something that your basic pediatrician is going to be able to do. It does take this expert evaluation.
Right.
So thank you so much for these insights. That's really, really fascinating. What else would you particularly like to tell our listeners about dealing with this situation? Both, let's talk first to pregnant people and then to parents who are on the verge of tearing out their hair.
Sure. I think there are a couple of things a couple of themes that I try to carry through the book. One is prevention. Getting information out there that, in fact, there is no amount of alcohol, tobacco, any kind of drug that is safe to use during pregnancy. Period. And we have to get that word out to both the public and to physicians, because a lot of physicians will say, well, a little bit of alcohol is okay. So that's from the prevention perspective. The other thing is, think those are the three things.
Right. So don't give up. Every child is an important piece of our social universe, and we want to make sure that that child learns to not be disruptive and not be violent in our society and feel well cared for and loved. And it's hard to do that when you're constantly feeling angry and exasperated at this child.
Right.
So both for the health of the parent and for the health of the child, it's important to get this kind of support and find the combination of tactics that works in helping this child achieve those goals.
Right.
Great. Well, thank you so much. Is there a website that we can send people to for more information?
Yes, there is a lot of information. If you go to the website NTIUpstream.com. So it's NTI stands for National Training Institute, but it's NTI Upstream, as in going upstream. NTIUpstream.com has a wealth of information. You can also access the book from there.
Great. So again, it's The Mystery of Risk by Ira J. Chasnoff, Chasnoff, MD, and it's about drugs, alcohol, pregnancy, and the vulnerable child. So prevention is the most important thing. So much damage, though, sometimes happens before the woman's even conscious that she's pregnant. And, of course, people who are deep into alcohol and drug abuse sometimes don't put much consciousness to that. And the other thing to remember is that half the pregnancies out there are not planned. So, of course, if you're planning a pregnancy, you can square off drugs and alcohol and tobacco. But if this is a surprise, by the time you realize you're pregnant, the window of opportunity for making sure the child has minimal exposure may be behind us. So we're also going to have to all take a part in remediation, and that means not only the parents involved with this child and the teachers involved with this child, but the entire social environment and those of us who vote and those of us who pay taxes, because we need all of our citizens to be healthy and cooperative and good voters. And so. Great. So thank you, everybody, for being with us, and thank you again, Dr. Kasnoff. Excellent book and a great discussion in spite of our technical difficulties today. So apologies to everybody for the little softnesses in the audio here, but I hope that everybody got most of it. And we'll be with you again next week. And meanwhile, be well and be a powerful patient. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.